right, and we're back. Today's episode 2 of the Snack Time, if you will. Again, I'm Mike Linneman, known as @VorthosMike, one of Gathering Magic's writers, and with me today is Ant.
Yep, and I'm Ant Tessitore, also Gathering Magic, or Gathering, wow, Gathering Magic.
Nailed it.
Gathering Magic writer.
It's a terrible Ant.
Ant MTG on Twitter.
That was already a failure, but we're going to keep working through it. We're still new at this. Again, we're working on the sound. I do not live in a fishbowl with my 3 wiener dogs and my beautiful wife, though we'll see today. Topic of the cast. Ant, what the hell are we talking about today?
All right, so today basically what we're going to cover is why Vorthos content is so important for Magic the Gathering. And how it makes the game better.
And okay, and Vorthos again is the type of player that has deep appreciation for the art, the flavor, the tie-ins to the game, which is generally storyline for in the past, that is outside of the player psychographics, which is not Timmy, Johnny, or Spike. It's a different thing.
Basically, Vorthos could care less about mechanics and wants to look at names, art, flavor text, packaging, anything that is creative and interesting on a fantasy level.
That's why we're called Snack Time. The best part is the taste. As we start out, we're going to have the flavor gems of the week. I'm going to start this out. One of my favorite artworks from the past, New Phyrexia. I worked some flavor text writing on this set, and the card is Surgical Extraction. It costs a Phyrexian mana, which could be paid with 2 life or a black, made by Stephen Belladin, not the BioBox. The Stephen Belladin version has one of the Mirrodin members and has a levitating skull and spine coming out of it. And this image is such a striking difference from really any of the other artworks of the set, because it can stand alone as this really otherworldly image. There's no other concept. There's no other context. And this art actually won a Spectrum Award in the Spectrum Annual Art Fantastical Art. And this piece is one of the few Stephen Belladin still owns. It's not for sale. And it is huge, utterly massive. The whole artwork is actually as tall as the card is. So there, it goes on for quite a ways. It's a beautiful piece, very balanced, very clear, and it's high concept. We don't generally get this high concept imagery very often. It's usually, dude kills guy, what does the spell do? Kill the guy, neat. Whereas this is, oh, I see, this is kind of a roundabout way of removing this target card entirely out of your deck by physically removing it by this concept. I think it's a beautiful piece, and one of Steven's best ever.
Now, Mike, you said that you did names and flavor text for this set, right?
I did indeed.
So do you know if this was actually what the concept requested, or if Steve kind of went out on his own and created this piece?
No, I do know. I could check into notes or get in trouble about it, but I'm sure the art description called, considering the BioBox promo is utterly the same art description of removing a spine and removing a skull, but Steve stripped away everything else. He didn't show a lot of Mirrodin. He didn't show it in battle. He didn't show a mage doing it. It was just the concept for the art description. And he said, okay, how much can I get by with making it be Mirrodin without hitting people over the head with it?
Right.
Because this is something you could put in a museum as a high, fantastic art, capital A, concept.
Yeah, one of the things that I really loved about the artwork for Mirrodin is that because it was such a unique setting, especially the Glimmer Void, like you could see those little interlocked hexagons and immediately know I'm on Mirrodin.
So
you didn't have to play around with the background. You didn't have to go out on a limb to do anything, you know, crazy to really drive home. This is the plane that we're on. It was just, you know, hexagonal plates on the ground. I know exactly where I am.
Bingo, bingo, I know. So what I'm going to do is below in this image, we're going to show one of the concept artworks because I actually own it. I own the Brian Snoddy original Mirrodin concept artwork. It's one of the few color-painted pieces that have left Wizards. For whatever reason, how it got out, I don't know. But I picked one up, purchased it from him, and I have it in my house. So we're going to show that so you can see, even from the beginning conceptual stages of what Mirrodin looked like to what it looks now, is very, very similar. Ant, what do you got for us for is that flavor? What do you got for that taste?
All right. So today my gem is the card Sleep. This card's been reprinted a couple times in M10, I believe M13, and then M15. But first, I just wanted to talk about the flavor text. So the concept of this card is obviously a spell that is putting a group of people to sleep, right? Very simple, very top-down.
Yep. Straightforward.
But the flavor text says, I give them dreams so wondrous that they hesitate to return to the world of the conscious. And it's quoted to Garlod, Merfolk Mage, whatever. But the mechanics of this card say, tap all creatures target player controls, and then those creatures do not untap during that player's next untap step. Now, one thing that I love to see in flavor text is when they are actually referencing the mechanics of the card, but done in a very subtle way. So everybody, I'm sure, everybody has had that experience where you're asleep and your alarm clock goes off and you're having a really good dream and you wake up and you immediately get this feeling of, ugh, I just want to go back to bed and I want to get back into that whatever dream you were having. And you almost instantaneously fall back asleep.
Right,
If you look at this card, the way that it plays is you tap down your opponent's creatures, playing up the idea of they're falling asleep. And then on their next turn, when they would normally wake up, they're in such a great slumber that they're like, oh, I just want to return back to being asleep again. And it plays up that idea perfectly. So I have no idea who wrote this flavor text, but whoever you are, if you're listening, kudos. You did an excellent job.
A plus. It is odd that it took this long to make Sleep.
Yeah.
Because most one-liners were used back in 1993. I mean, Teleport. Like, oh my God, why did they have to use that so early? Yeah. I mean, really perfect names, and I know Doug argues and gets angry about this all the time of, man, I wish we wouldn't have shot our gun early then. Because this is a Dungeons & Dragons spell. I mean, 101, level 1 AD&D spell, drop that D6, D8, make the dude sleep, you kill the kobolds, you win.
Right. And I think, honestly, I think that part of it is because for the longest time, tapping down a creature in Magic anyway, was conceptualized as ice or freezing.
Right.
And that kind of brings us into our next part here where we're going to be talking about concepting of cards and how that's important to the game of Magic. When a set's being developed, the design and the development happens first. The creative team gets this bunch of cards that have absolutely no concept. They don't have art yet. They don't have a name yet. They don't have flavor text yet. It's just mechanics. And it's their job to look at these different cards and say, okay, what does this represent? How am I going to send a description to the artist to say, hey, paint me a bunch of people that are asleep on the ground? Or, you know, this card to the flavor text and naming team and say, you know, this is what we're shooting for. Come up with an interesting name that sums up mechanically what's going on.
Right, and it's like, what's a 2/2 flyer? Is it a griffin? Is it a pegasus? Is it a little dragon? I mean, all of those things are so liquid. And even at that stage, I mean, the difference between a red flyer and a white flyer is pretty close. Or conversely, a white flyer and a black flyer to figure out which one of these does it need to be and why. What's thematically fitting? Because you can't have, you know, 6/6 angels flying around everywhere. But if you get a lot of 3/3s and 4/4s, okay, well, that makes sense.
Right. Obviously, when a design is being done and it's a top-down design, they already have this idea in their head, like, okay, I'm going to try and make a sleep spell, right? So the concepting is already done at that stage. But more often than not, the designer is just saying, okay, I'm going to make a sorcery where it says tap down these creatures. And it's up to the conceptor to be like, well, what does that mean? Like, how do I come up with a flavorful way to represent that in the game? And Mark Rosewater's commented a million times that flavor is way more flexible than mechanics. So part of the thing that's so interesting in Magic is that this card alone, when you strip it down, it's just 4 converted mana cost sorcery, taps down creatures. Like, this could easily be putting creatures to sleep, as this card is, or it could have been freeze a bunch of creatures for 2 turns. It could have been use psychic energy to paralyze a bunch of creatures for 2 turns. Or it could have been an Azorius spell on Ravnica that detained creatures for 2 turns. Like, the flavor could have gone in so many different directions. And that's one way where it actually can really help improve the game.
Right. And a lot of this, it's best to do this top-down of the Innistrad, okay, what affects a human? What will be the thing that immobilizes an entire field of soldiers. Oh, tap down their dudes from vampire fear or something of that sort. And that's thematically fitting, whereas, say, in another set, there's a lot of dragons. Oh, it's in awe of the dragon, and all your guys are frozen by looking at in awe and brilliance of that. So those concepts can be interchanged, but you can't just repeat those all the time, because then players become wise to it and say, well, this is kind of ham-handed.
Right. But one thing that I would really like to see them do more is that whenever, because every set, Wizards is going to do some functional reprints, right? It's going to happen. But what I would really like to see is when they know they're going to do a functional reprint, I want them to come at it from a totally different flavor angle of the previous one. So as a very simple example, if they were to reprint Sleep in another set, but they were going to change it up and give it a different name, I would love for them to concept this as like an ice spell freezing the targets or something like that. Because although the cards are identical, what that allows players to do is when they go to craft their decks, let's say I sit down and I want to have four copies of this card in my deck.
Yep.
Now that it's been reprinted, I get to have this option where I get to make a flavor choice. And I can say, okay, well, which one fits my deck better thematically? Do I want to have a card that puts creatures to sleep, or do I want to have a card that freezes my opponent? And if I'm crafting a deck that plays up being a fire and ice mage, I'm obviously going to want that ice version.
Well, let me ask you this, Ant. If someone that's maybe a more competitive player happens to listen to us, you know, God bless them, why does that matter? Why does that matter to Wizards to say, we're going to dedicate staff, resources, time to say, we're not going to do a reprint, we're going to make a slightly variance in flavor? Is there money that is backed up to that? I mean, are there that many casual players that will appreciate that and buy product because of it?
See, I would argue that there are, because I know of multiple casual players, especially EDH players, who really try to craft their decks along a flavorfully thematic route.
Would you even say that that's a stage in playing?
What do you mean by a stage?
Well, when you this is going to curtail into the next point of the I'm going to play this game, I like elves, or whoa, that's a cool dragon, I want to build a dragon deck. And that stage of this introduction to the game is, I'm a red wizard, I'm going to make goblin deck, and I want all my stuff to look goblin-y and have this goblin art and goblin flavor. And why do I have to use this weird spell for minotaurs when I'm all goblins?
Right. See that, so it's really interesting, because for a new player, and I've actually written an article about this, where for a new player, it makes more sense to them to play a game where the flavor lines up with what they're doing, right? Like, if you hand a new player a Splinter Twin combo deck, they're not going to have any idea what's going on because they've never played the game before, and they're not going to understand any of these mechanical interactions, again, because they've never played the game before.
Most people don't start as Johnnies, I get you. Okay,
right,
that makes sense.
But what they also can't do is they can't relate Splinter Twin to anything else that they know, because that's a very magic only deck. But if you gave them a deck that was thematically a pyromancer, right, so it was full of fire spells, it summoned fire elementals, it's a simpler deck,
i.e. Duels of the Planeswalkers 101 mantra, okay,
right.
I get that.
It's also easier for that new player to say, oh, these spells make sense to me because I'm playing as a pyromancer, and I know what a pyromancer is already, right?
Okay, so you're saying...
So on that end, it makes sense. But what's even more interesting is, as you become more and more enfranchised, you start to shy away from flavor, and you start to look at how do all my cards interact mechanically, whatever. But some players get to a point where they no longer care so much about their deck being the most efficient that it can be mechanically, and they start to more try to tailor their decks on an artistic level. So like, I personally build decks all the time where I'm trying to craft a theme, or I'm trying to create some type of feel for my opponents as well as myself while I'm playing. And when I do that, I absolutely look for different variations in the cards that have a slightly different flavor feel to them. They're mechanically the same, but the flavor is different enough that it fits my deck better and furthers my play experience.
Okay, I'm going to counter that and say, I don't make flavorful decks. I really don't. I make decks that are a little more spike oriented. If the entire point is to win, why would I not do that? But I attack it from a different perspective, and I think this is where you and I greatly differ, but we meet in the middle in that if I have two choices for a ramp spell or to find a land in my deck, I will always choose the one with a better flavor, even though they may be the same, maybe even the better flavorful one is cheaper, the foil is cheaper, what have you.
Right.
I will always choose the one that looks cooler, feels cooler, and has a better art that's fitting what I'm looking for. And I think that's a lot of what Commander does, is either you do the theme, or you have a card pool and you're like, well, I have six choices here and two choices there and three choices there, and I want to have the best flavorful things in there because they bring me nostalgia, or they bring me a representation of a storyline that I remember reading. And I don't think very often people talk about that. We just naturally do it.
Yeah, I would agree to that, because I've been doing that for years before I realized that I was different than my current playgroup, because nobody in my playgroup gives anything. Like, they just do not care about the flavor of their deck at all. They are so much more worried about how well their mechanical interactions, like, play out and what wacky, crazy things. They're mostly Johnnies, but they still could care less if they're strapping, you know, Lightning Greaves onto a Slagworm. Like, to me, I'm like, that doesn't make any sense. I don't want to do that in my game, right? Because a Slagworm doesn't have legs. Like, that just bugs me. Like, right. I have this internal dialogue where it's like, don't, even if it's the smartest play, and this is a reason why I don't play competitively, because even if it's the smartest play, I'll avoid doing that, because in my heart of hearts, I'm like, that doesn't make any sense. And I can't get over it. So when I go to build a deck, I might be an absolute extreme, but I take lengths to make sure that the cards that I'm picking line up perfectly with whatever theme I have in mind.
So, you will never be my two-headed giant partner.
I probably shouldn't.
That will never happen.
Or maybe it should, because it would be very entertaining for whoever we were playing.
Stripes. God, we'd get crushed.
Yeah. Okay, but I will agree with you on the fact that I always go for the card that has the best art.
I mean, you should have the one with the best flavor, and you pick through your things. We do this unconsciously of, I'm not using that white border corset land because they look like crap. And they do. They look utterly terrible. If you look up The Purple Mountain by John Avon in Mirage, it looks beautiful. If you look at ones when it was reprinted in a corset, it looks like garbage. I mean, it's so much more washed out. It's just depressing looking. I mean, you look at the 8th edition one, same art, but by adding so much more white around it, it washes it out. It makes it feel like you're at a garage sale. So why I want to talk about why this flavor is so important to the game in artistic and in aesthetic reach is that Vorthos really provides you as your first step. It's not coming into the game in which you say, I'm a mathematician, I want to do math for 12 hours straight in a Grand Prix ballroom and just do calculations all day. That's not generally what brings people into the game. Usually it's a friend, and there's some sort of flavorful thing that ties you in, most notably the art. This is why we see planeswalkers done by amazing artists and why they're everywhere, because they look great. And they're fitting. So this aspect of what they do, this of our creative team, is they write the art description, as Ant mentioned, get the concept. Here's what you got to do. Okay, well, what the hell are each one of these things are? What are we going to call them? What is the art going to be? And at this point, creative has kind of already figured out the planeswalkers, because they're important to the overall set. Kind of figured out the legendary characters already, what they're kind of going to fit in. But what they haven't figured out yet is all the little guys. Should there be humans? Should there be angels? Why should they be now? Should they be sitting on a shelf? Every single one of the fan favorites has to be discussed at this stage of the, are we going to have squirrels in this set? Cripes, are we going to have squirrels? Should we have squirrels? Should there be minotaurs? Should orcs in red come back? Should dwarves come back? These giant questions, because they're visceral to people. And why magic even has art is because it's visceral to you. And it's not only on an emotional level, but it speeds up retention. So say you're playing limited or a draft or a sealed pool, what have you. Often when you've played enough of a set and you've practiced, you don't read the card anymore. You literally pick it up and see the art and immediately know what it is. That's what differentiates Magic from Uno. By having art that is very unique, it allows us to speed up the game, brings people in because it's interesting, and you get to find your own little niches. A question for Ant. Do you remember Phil Folio? Phil Incognifolio.
Oh, absolutely.
A crazy, whimsical, cartoony, playful art.
You know, I mean, Magic is serious, and we all take it very seriously, but I liked every once in a while finding, you know, a picture of an orc who's a librarian, and he's eating a book and, like, putting paste on it. And, like, I just, like, ugh, like, something about those little snippets of just goofiness is what I really used to love about Magic as a kid.
Which is funny, because it was the time of your life that it mattered.
Exactly. That's a great point.
And that's something we're not all jumping in on, is that how many alumni players are coming back because they played as teenagers in that mid-90s time where there was a very serious Weatherlight storyline. That's why you see Jared and his crew freaking everywhere on the art. But at the same time, there was this whimsy of a fish hook in someone's mouth and all sorts of weird crap going on. Well, they also didn't have a style guide back then. So as part of this, there's now more market research into what do gamers want? What do you want to see? Oh, you want to see strong, badass women. Okay, done. We'll do it. I want to see immersive level experiences of the art. Okay, cool. We'll do that. I want to see storyline transitioned over time. Things like Deicide kind of break that mold, but I want to see a progression of seeing what the hell's going on with the set. Okay, done. We can do that. But by doing that, you lose this playfulness, this time out of battle to see the normal parts of the game as well. You never see anybody in love in the game. You never see anybody just cooking. You never see anybody using a latrine. I mean, the normal parts of any adventuring party or a bar even anymore. Those things don't really exist. And I'm curious if players want them, or it's just a nostalgic impact because that was visceral that they could tie themselves into this playfulness.
Well, I think part of it, so the one part, I do know that there are a lot of flavor text writers now who are trying to get more, like what you mentioned about there, you don't really see like players in love or anything like that. There are definitely writers trying to get that back in. I know that Theros, MJ Scott, wrote this piece on, I believe it's Opaline Unicorn, where she crafted this tiny little myth about how Purphoros was madly in love with Nylea, and he crafted these unicorns for her to kind of like run around through her forests. And it's little snippets like that that not only did that perfectly fit the Greek theme, but it also created this nice little narrative where you're like, oh man, these characters don't just get someone to the battlefield and smash each other to pieces. They actually care about each other. And it really helps to kind of invest you, I think, into the characters more and into the game more. But I can understand why, you know, when they're trying to have this serious tone, especially in like New Phyrexia, and, you know, or Innistrad, and they have all these horror-like tropes or different, like, feelings are trying to make you, you know, almost feel afraid why they wouldn't want to have, you know, somebody running around with a fish lure in their mouth. Like, that makes sense to me. But where I think those type of images could still be utilized is in supplementary products.
Well, and those are getting limited. The core set is now gone.
The core set is gone, but you still have things like Commander where, if anything, Commander being such a casual audience, you could slip something like a Phil Foglio-esque art description into it. And they've kind of done that with the second Commander release where they had Acorn Catapult and you basically shot acorns at people and gave them a squirrel. Like that's starting to get, that's a little goofy. Or Hot Soup. That was in the core set. But that could have easily been in a Commander product. Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So I definitely think that they are aware of the fact that players want that kind of stuff, but it seems like they're going slow to the point where, like, when you're testing your water, like, you put your big toe in to see if the water's too cold, and then you take it out and you wait, and, like, they're going very slow, but there are indications that they're trying to plant these little bits of goofiness back into the game.
But we can basically understand that the two reasons why this isn't more prevalent are the style guide, most notably, because it defines the world, defines really what's going on, but by doing that, it forces artists to stay within that box. Often they feel a little nervous about really expanding out because it's, oh, you're going to be asked to revise that. When in reality, they don't that often, but if you get too weird, you may not get asked to get another commission.
Right.
So that's a balancing act. And then the second part is we do have brand teams now. Back in the mid-90s, there were no brand managers watching what things were going. It was, you know, card concept art, boom, out the door.
It was like the Wild West.
It was the Wild West. I mean, there were smart people going through, but there wasn't the taskmaster that could really say, is this really what we're trying to represent? Because no one was removed enough to really make that decision back then either. Staff was smaller too. All right, so so when you have that flavor, when you got that art, how do you go about the names and flavor text to inform the world? Ant and I both did writing. We've both done flavor text writing. I'm terrible at it. I don't work well under those deadlines, I'll admit.
I loved it. As of right now, I have written for one set that I absolutely cannot talk about because it has not been announced or anything. And I don't even know yet what submissions of mine have gotten selected. But I do know that the experience, I absolutely loved it. I loved it. I might be atypical, but I had, you know, spreadsheet all set up, and I tracked every card that I submitted for and what names I put, and I was absolutely in heaven. I had so much fun doing it.
I was so manic about it. I used to go on our train every day to work. It was a light rail, and I'd have a notebook, and I would just write idea after idea after idea. And I remember looking at other people who submitted, and I'm like, man, all of my ideas totally suck. Because I didn't write to the perspective of informing the world or the players. I really looked at the art and then moved from there. And that's not how you're supposed to do it.
Oh, really? Yeah, no.
Not supposed to do it at all.
When I found out that I was going to be on the team, I went back and I reread every single article written by both Matt Cavada and Doug Baer about writing flavor text. I think, and there's almost like 150 where they just talk about what makes good flavor text. And then I went through the past 10 sets and created a list of all the different types of flavor text you can write, whether it be from the point of view of the person on the card or from the point of view of someone interacting with the person on the card or a quote from outside of the card or whatever. Like I have,
or humor or poems.
Yeah,
or whatever.
Well, actually, humor, this is an aside, but how do you feel about humor as a flavor text?
I think it's not used enough, and it needs to. Adrian Reynolds on the Twitters, Dreamtime Drin, often yells about this to say, where's the playfulness? If we're not going to do it on the art, if we're not going to do it on the name, why isn't it in the flavor? This is the perfect opportunity. And I utterly agree with her. There's three parts to the card of the name, the art, and the flavor. And the subtype, I suppose. But all of those things should be almost like you're touching an elephant. One part is the trunk, one part is the tail, one part's the ear, one part's the leg. Two of them shouldn't describe the same frickin' thing and say, oh, Elf in the Woods, what's the artwork? Elf in the Woods. I mean, that's just lazy naming, and it's tropey and stupid. Whereas if you just put Argothian Elf, well, it's dumb, okay. Whereas it really inform that better, and that's an ideal that we could move toward.
Here's the thing, though. Like, the job of flavor text, when you have a card, you have the art, you have the mechanic. Sometimes that's all you need to be able to paint the picture of, okay, this is a dragon, these mechanics perfectly make sense for a dragon, I'm good to go, right?
Right.
At that point, you don't need a name where it says dragon and a flavor text that says dragons come through and blah, 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 blah. Like, that, I agree, is redundant. But
yeah,
that is atypical. most of the time you get this weird mechanic that kind of matches up with the art, but not really.
Yep.
And it's flavor text job to kind of fill that gap. And you can kind of think about it as like a brick wall. You have two bricks, and the flavor text and the naming is the mortar in between that is holding those two bricks together. Matt Cavada said this on his Drive to Work podcast with Mark Rosewater. I think it was like number 50 or something. It was one of his early ones,
yeah.
Or like 30 or something. But that, to me, is an absolute perfect analogy, because it is the flavor text job to bridge that gap between the mechanical world and the artistic world. And flavor is in there kind of cradling both of them together. And
what, unless it's Commander that had too much frickin' mechanic,
right.
No room for flavor, which is
all
bullshit.
Like, choose your opponents and all this stuff. And like, how are you going to do that? And a lot of those cards didn't even have flavor text.
No, I know.
Because they read them and they're like, none of these make any sense. But regardless, what also happens during development and during design is that cards change. So initially a card could be, you know, a wizard that taps a guy down. And so the conceptor says, hey, draw me a wizard who looks like he's using an ice spell. But then all of a sudden development's like, oh, we have too many tap effects, and they'll change it to draw a card. Well, now all of a sudden you have this wizard who's flinging ice around, and the ability says draw a card, and you're like, well, how the hell does that make any sense? So it comes to the flavor text writer, and it's their job to figure out a creative way to meld the two. So maybe you'll call the guy, I don't know, I'm doing this off the top of my head, but like, you know, Ice Scry Wizard or whatever, and you write this interesting little flavor thing where the wizard is kind of insane, and what he does is he flings these ice crystals out, and as they're flying by, he tells the future in the light reflected in ice crystals.
Sure.
Like, that is something that a flavor text, that's where the creativity of a writer can help improve the game.
Right.
If you take a card like Gorilla Titan, it's a 4/4 ape creature. The art is awesome. It's this crazy kind of like combination of a baboon and a gorilla and a tiger. The dude's like standing up in a tree, looks really intimidating, right? The mechanics, it has trample, gets +4/+4 as long as there are no other cards in your graveyard. Like, it's a really scary creature. Then you read the flavor text, it says, I want a banana this big. Like, the entire feeling of that card is now like, eh, like it's a groaner. And yeah, there'll be like maybe one or two people who love it, but everyone else is kind of like, oh, that's whatever, you know? And if you were the artist who spent all that time drawing and painting this badass gorilla monster, right? Because
right.
You did your work way before the flavor text writer does their work. So you spent all this time putting in all this detail, making this really amazing monster. And then some flavor text writer comes in and looks at your art for 2 seconds, goes, huh, that'd be funny if there was a big banana in there, and writes, I want a banana this big, and totally devalues what you spent all your time on.
I get that entirely. I mean, at the same time, that also pushes people to come to your table at a convention to get it signed, or will you alter a banana in here? So,
which is true, and I agree to...
It is a hit to the ego, no doubt about
it. It's touchy, and like, for certain artists who definitely kind of embrace that goofiness, like, I'm sure RK Post would absolutely love to draw
Randy
bananas on there,
that.
And maybe, like, some other, you know, appendages,
Steve Argyle's
whatever
your dog
the hell
too.
He wants, right? But maybe other artists aren't into that. Maybe they would kind of be like, oh, man, like, that's kind of a downer, you know? I don't know. So, like, there are places for it, and I definitely don't want to see it leave Magic. And I also don't want to see it restricted to only Goblins. Like, I think you could definitely branch it out. But I also, you know, especially when I'm writing flavor text, I try to really look at the art, going back to what you were saying about when you're on the train and you would look at the art and try to come up with what's going on there. I really try to sit there and look at the art and try to picture it as if, okay, I was the artist and I painted this picture. What was I going for? Like, what message was I trying to get through in my art? And in thinking that way, I try to put myself on the same wavelength as them so that my flavor text doesn't take away from all the work that they did, but enhances it. And I think that that is another way that flavor text writers can help add to the game, by making sure that they're lining up with, you know, what the people who have come before them have already done.
Right. I totally agree. And I mean, the name of the card should give some of that as well, though often I'm finding more and more names are either the exact description or a shorthand that players can use to being thematically really close to this is the world. This is what's going on. Oh, this is on New Phyrexia. And I'm happy that our flavor writers are so good at this, and even the staff members get involved. I'm not sure if everyone knows, but it's not just outside people that do write flavor text. It's the creative team, but they also pull in other people from throughout the company as well to say, hey, you want to give it a go with this? And people come up with the strangest submissions for names. They really do, just to get really background historical examples, like referencing books from 1994 that you may not even ever notice, even going through a set, but there's a subsect of players who definitely look for those sort of things.
There's a lot that goes into the creative side of the game. And really, when you look at a card, arguably half of it is Vorthos content.
Well, this has been fun. We'd love to hear more on why this is important, but we'll keep it short today. How about that? And Where can people get a hold of you for follow-up if they have questions?
Hey, if they have questions or they want to talk to me about this further, they can hit me up on Twitter at ANMTG, or they can comment. I'll put the show notes up on Gathering Magic with the post, and they can feel free to talk in there. I know. See, what you said was from Heavy Meta, you know that they don't comment, but from Snack Time, I know that they do comment because
they comment because they can't listen and hear me. They're like, Mike, you sound terrible.
Tell me that you sounded like you were in a fish tank.
So, I live in a fish tank.
But that's okay, because I would much rather have people who care about my podcast and want it to sound better than none
Amen.
At all.
And if people want to get a hold of me, I'm at Vorthos Mike on the Twitters. Otherwise, I'm not hard to find online. You can Google me. I have a cousin with the same name, but he doesn't do crap online, so you'll find me. Want to thank you guys again for everybody who's listened, guys and gals, and we'll see you next time very soon.